All right, welcome everybody to Millennials Are Killing Capitalism Live. It's great to be with you today. Please take a minute and like, share, subscribe, support the Patreon. But most importantly, just share the conversation, make sure people have a chance to see it. This should be really good. If anybody is into the conversations that we've had on counterinsurgency over the years, Malaya comes up a lot, right? It's a really important, honestly, like there's debates, and we'll talk about this a little bit, about what constitutes the beginning of counterinsurgency and you know, where does sort of colonialism, because counterinsurgency comes out of colonialism, it comes out of colonial warfare. And so like, trying to cite a beginning is a difficult thing. You know, I know Dylan Rodriguez really looks at the Philippines and the U.S. occupation of the Philippines as kind of his jumping off point. But a lot of people, you know, cite the so-called Malaya emergency, which is really, I guess, for Great Britain, kind of a starting point, which is, I mean, for the UK, I guess I should say. Or the British Empire probably would be the more accurate way to say it, is really the starting point, which is strange, obviously, because British colonialism is a long thing and they were always fighting against colonized subjects. So we'll get into all of that. But nonetheless, regardless of where we think about that origin point, it is really important in terms of the development of counterinsurgency tactics and like discourses and books around counterinsurgency. So we'll talk about all of that, but I'm really excited because it's not something that we've ever talked about in any detail. And I saw this piece a couple of weeks ago. People probably saw it, or some of you may have seen it, White Supremacy and Anti-Communism as Counterinsurgency Lessons from British Imperialism in Malaya. The author, Fadia Nadwa Fikri, is going to join us today to discuss it. She is a lawyer and scholar of Southeast Asian studies. Her work examines the intellectual history of decolonization, Malay radical politics, and the British racializing project with a focus on Malaya and Singapore. So without further ado, Fadia, it's good to be with you. Thank you for joining us today. Looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. We have somebody watching from Sumatera, Indonesia right now. Good to see you. I'm excited. I know that we do have people who tune into us from that region, and it's one of the regions that we have discussed the least historically. So looking forward to this very much. So just to start, like, it's your first time on the show. Really honored to have you. We have mutual friends. Shout out to our friend Louis Alday. I wondered if up front you could just start with kind of like a little bit of a brief introduction of yourself, if there's anything you want to add beyond the, you know, sentence that I read.
Thank you so much, Jared. Since we're going to talk about counterinsurgency, I think I have to share a little bit about my involvement in the NGO human rights industrial complex. I was a human rights lawyer before I started my PhD at the National University of Singapore. I was in that field for almost 10 years. And I even co-founded an organization, a lawyer organization for human rights. And the funding came from the NED and also the OSI. And of course, you know, at the time, everyone who was involved in this industrial complex, you know, they didn't feel like something was wrong about that, about getting funding from the US. And we see a lot of leaders, like NGO leaders, for example, getting awards from the United States, and how, I mean, I was also part of that movement. And then, of course, because of, you know, a lot of fragments of consciousness that I had throughout my career as a human rights lawyer, I started questioning a lot of things, having seen people, for example, in court. I did a lot of legal aid cases back then, and, you know, seeing poor people getting denied representation, seeing people getting charged under the Sedition Act that we inherited from the British, and then seeing people getting evicted, like workers, plantation workers particularly. So that kind of opened my eyes to what I was doing at the time. I then realized that I didn't want to be complicit anymore in perpetuating this idea that the world can change by getting involved in the NGO human rights industrial complex, because it's very limiting. You know, I've seen how human rights also has been used as a weapon to really justify aggression and war against a lot of people. So yeah, so I decided, I mean, it felt almost like a moment of redemption when I decided that I wanted to put a stop to this, and I wanted to study the history that was completely erased from our collective memory, the anti-colonial struggle in Malaya and Singapore. Singapore cannot be divorced, you know, from Malaya, because we have always been one entity, like pre-colonial entity. And also Indonesia, of course, you know, that relation. We're going to talk about that later more. And yeah, so here I am. So I just defended my thesis 2 months ago. And
Congratulations.
yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much. So yeah, I'm looking forward to talking more about counterinsurgency and also my research. Yeah.
No, look forward to that. I mean, I will say, as somebody who spent 15 years in the nonprofit industrial complex myself too, it's tough when you're in it and then you look back on it and you think about, gosh, like I was so naive. But at the same time, like, these are the things that you're like, we're channeled into these tracks. And so anyway, I appreciate you sharing that up front and just being like, open about it. And I think that, yeah, it's important. And a lot, I mean, any of us, I think, that are involved in like the nonprofit world or the legal world around human rights or stuff like that, like, just very challenging because of the limited channels that people have to do good work. And what you're encouraged and told is like the good work to do is very often, based in counterinsurgency. So, yeah, anyway, appreciate that and really looking forward to this discussion, as I said. So you start your piece talking about the prescription of Palestine action. And I do want to say, because we just recently added it to the schedule, that in about 2.5 hours, we're going to have a conversation with a couple of people associated with that to talk about the hunger strikes that are going on. We're going to have on the show Francesca Nadine, and Calla Walsh is going to join us as well to talk about Prisoners for Palestine hunger strike, which is those hunger strikers. So you begin kind of talking about this process, which has played out over the last 6 months or so, where Palestine Action has been, prescribed by the United Kingdom as a terrorist organization for engaging in direct action against weapons manufacturers, and the shock of many within the UK, have felt that their country has become, as you put in quotes, unrecognizable and authoritarian. And so I love to, as you talk about in the piece, how these reactions struck you, and then taking us back to this history of the Malaya emergency. So yeah, if you could start there.
When I was reading news about the prescription of Palestine Action, obviously, you know, I saw a lot of people, you know, in the United Kingdom saying stuff like, "Oh, I've not recognized this country anymore." I think what enraged me was this idea that, you know, how a lot of people in the imperial core, you know, they have the luxury of not learning about their own history even after witnessing what happened in Gaza. And it's just, I think it also reminded me of the time that I spent in the UK. I did my master's degree in international human rights law in England in 2016, 2017. So I still remember, you know, my experience confronting the imperial core. For this course, I mean, this program particularly, it was designed many years ago to really get people from the human rights field to advance their career, basically. So we have judges, we have people working for UN institutions, enrolling in this program, and also the instructors were basically at the time like judges and also prosecutors. And I remember they assigned us this book written by Adam Hochschild. It's called The Ghost of King Leopold. It's about the crimes committed in Belgium, in the Congo by the Belgian king. And when they asked us to talk about the book, so I still remember my first class, and they were like, okay, what do you think about the book? So I said something about the book, and I mentioned imperialism and colonialism. And the instructor, the lecturer, actually told me that, you know what, we're not interested in talking about imperialism or colonialism. Let's just focus on the human rights violations. And I was so enraged. I was questioning myself, like my own existence there. Like, what am I doing? Like, what am I perpetuating? They're not interested at all in dismantling systems that are creating all this misery and mass death and suffering and terror. And of course, when I read, now I think people are still like, oh, this is not Britain, or this is not the United Kingdom, this is not the US. I'm like, what do you mean when you talk about that? I feel like they're still internalizing, they're still trying to defend this idea of the empire. They're still trying to feel or to convince themselves that the empire is benevolent, that the empire is, doing whatever it can to civilize the rest of the world. They feel like they're defending the free world. And I feel like this is something that we have to confront, because I don't think we can still talk about this, because people are dying, people are being incinerated alive as we speak. And you can still somehow feel like, oh, you don't have to educate yourself, you don't even have to like pay more attention to the rest of the world. We are now, for example, witnessing the imminent war in Venezuela. And I mean, don't you feel anything, right? So that's why I feel seeing all these reactions made me feel so angry. So the anger, I think it comes from having to confront this reality, about how we descendants of the colonized, how colonization, or this system that oppresses us all, is basically emptying us out of our own soul. They're trying to say that we are a people that does not have our own history. We're not capable of participating in the conception of the world. We don't have that radical history where we want to liberate ourselves from imperialist oppression. So yeah, I mean, and I feel like what's happening is also interesting, because at the same time you see Palestine action, you see all these people putting their lives on the line and their liberty on the line, trying to stop or disrupt the imperial capitalist machine. And you also have the rest in the imperial core still trying to somehow rehabilitate this idea about the empire. So yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it's also a yeah, there's a big displacement that goes on with just putting everything on the Zionist entity, right? Or Israel, right? As just like, oh, and I mean, it's hard not to in some ways, right? Because this is where you see like the fullest expression of this genocidal violence unfolding, right? But there's a way that people want to, yeah, distance themselves or feel like we're not the one, like obviously we, but like our state and our country aren't the ones that are doing that, right? Our tax dollars aren't paying for that, all of those kinds of things. And the weapons that are being used aren't flowing from, from our manufacturers and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you could have as a group like Palestine Action is all ha was all focused on exposing the complicity of and trying to end the complicity of Great Britain from this from Zionist genocide and everything, that you would have people still saying, oh, this isn't us, and at the same time, it's quite interesting. So moving into your piece a little bit more, you write about the importance of Malaya to the British Empire, particularly on the heels of World War II, in terms of reconfiguring its foothold in Southeast Asia, but also the role specifically for capital accumulation within the empire. So could you talk a little bit about those elements and how the logic of accumulation exposed, the liberal regime? And so I want you to explain that a little bit too, because obviously there's some changes in how the British Empire manages this colonial relationship in this period as well.
Yeah, so after the Second World War, because the empire lost India and also Burma, so they decided to, okay, how do we reconfigure our position in Southeast Asia? So they saw Malaya as this place where they could rebuild their dominance in the region, particularly. And of course, because Malaya was extremely wealthy, Malaya was the largest dollar earners for Britain due to its lucrative tin and rubber production. And we have British lords in Parliament saying stuff like, oh, Malaya is actually the greatest prize in Southeast Asia, so we have to defend Malaya because of that. And also it's very interesting to see how Malaya, because of its wealth, it's also something that the British needed at the time to ensure its effective participation in NATO. And the US actually acknowledged the fact that without Britain, without the wealth in Malaya, we could never strengthen this organization. So I would like to just share what a report released in 1951 by the CIA on the significance of Malaya to both US imperialism and also British imperialism. So the report states that the loss of Malaya's dollar earnings would be a severe blow to the US. The consequent maladjustment that would be created in the strategic material and in the balance of payment position of the NATO countries could result in a serious setback in the rate of NATO rearmament. So it shows that at the time, they needed to ensure that Malaya, the wealth that Malaya had, would not fall to the hands of the communists, because at the time they saw what was happening in Vietnam, and they said and they believed that if Vietnam falls at the time, this is what they said, they were discussing the condition at the time, particularly in Vietnam. If Vietnam falls to the hands of the communists, Malaya would be next. So Malaya would succumb to the same fate. So they were so scared, they have this fear that communism would spread all over Southeast Asia. So they decided to use Malaya as an ark, like an anti-communist ark, to ensure that communism cannot be spread in Southeast Asia. And of course, they understood that Malaya too would not easily give up the struggle for national liberation, because because of that close relationship, for example, that the communists in Malaya had with Vietnamese communists. So Ho Chi Minh was instrumental actually in the formation of the Malayan Communist Party. So he came to Malaya in 1930, 1931 to help build a foundation for the party. And also it's very interesting how the communists in Indonesia were also working closely with not just the communists from the NCP, but also the nationalists, the Malay nationalists at the time, because they were trying to implement this policy by Comintern, where they have to indigenize communism in Southeast Asia. So it's very interesting to see how all these close relationships that the nationalists, the Islamists in Indonesia, in Malaya particularly, that they had these relationships where they were training each other, not just militarily, but also in terms of knowledge production. So I remember, doing a lot of work about how the Malayan communists and also nationalists and Islamists were collaborating with a lot of Indonesian communists. So they set up this school called the Marxist School of Malaya, where all nationalists from the Malay Nationalist Party, they had to attend the course. And of course, the course would be led by a lot of radicals from Indonesia. So it's very interesting how, all these connections were forged at the time. And of course, the British, they were paying a lot of attention to all these possibilities of having a socialist project, a communist project, in Malaya and also in Indonesia. And of course, it was also already happening in Vietnam. So yeah, I answered your question regarding how the significance that Malaya had, at the time to both British imperialism and also US imperialism.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned too in the piece is like the because of what Japan, like the role that Japan had in World War II, like also destabilizing, British imperialism in the region to some degree. Could you just share that a little bit?
So when Britain got defeated by Japan, so Japan ruled Malaya for almost 2 years. And during that period, it's actually interesting because that period somehow created some kind of space for a lot of nationalists, a lot of Islamists, and also a lot of communists in Malaya to start talking about politics openly. Because I think the Japanese, they tried to forge an alliance with a lot of the Malays at the time, because they felt like if we go too hard against these people, they're going to just rebel, and we cannot afford to lose this war. So we're going to just cooperate with them. So they allow a lot of newspapers, published by all these different groups, to just talk about this idea of national liberation. And of course, they thought that that would all these people would support, Japanese rule. And of course, they were wrong, and they started realizing that, oh no, they're just using this space that we're giving them to strengthen, the national liberation struggle. So they're going to just kick us out, just like how, they have always wanted to kick the British out. So of course, that changed a lot of things in Malaya at the time in terms of organizing, and their sudden defeat, somehow, made the British feel like, okay, all right, we have to come back to Malaya and ensure that, this space is no longer available, and we have to try and crack down as soon as possible. Because of course, at the time, Indonesia was on the verge of getting their own independence, and they know how close the Indonesians were with Malayan nationalists and also communists, and they felt like, okay, we have to just ensure that Malaya would not get independence at the time, after the Japanese surrendered. So they came back and they started talking about, okay, we're not going to recolonize you, we're just here to prepare you for self-government. So that is the narrative that they used at the time to justify their recolonization of Malaya. Because of course, at the time they were talking about this idea of human rights and self-determination, so they have to act like they care about the people's right to self-determination. So they're here just to facilitate, they're here to just ensure that, they are protected from other forces that would stop them from getting self-government. But the radicals at the time, the Malay radicals, the communists understood that, nope, this is just a different way of trying to recolonize Malaya, and we're not going to allow that to happen. So of course, at the time, the British felt like, okay, all right, this is not going to hold, because a lot of these people are very organized right now, and we have to do something about that, because the period in it during the Japanese occupation allowed them to have that kind of space to really strengthen the national liberation movement. And yeah, and they started thinking about, okay, all right, we're going to have to start preparing Malaya, so that it could serve as an anti-communist ark to stop what was going on in Vietnam at the time, and also to stop what was going on in Indonesia at the time. So yeah, so in 1947, you see all this formation of anti-colonial groups, and also the formation of the first multi-ethnic anti-colonial left-wing united front called the Putra EMCJ Coalition. So this coalition was the first in Malaya, actually, and it managed to unite both the Malay left and also the non-Malay left and the British. And of course, this coalition, they were very vocal about, their opposition to the British plan to come back and, prepare the people of Malaya for self-government, because they understood that that's just, that's not the reality, because they needed Malaya at the time because of the wealth that Malaya had. So yeah, and of course, like 1947, the first multi-ethnic United Front was formed, and 1948, the Declaration of Emergency was put in place. And this coalition of the Malay left and also the non-Malay left was completely wiped out. All of them, all the different organizations that were part of that coalition were proscribed, and most of the people who managed to resist arrest, to escape, they joined the MCP in the forest, to take up arms and start, the Revolutionary War against the British at the time. Yeah.
Well, thank you for all of that. This piece obviously talks about divide and conquer tactics, which are really, I mean, this is like fundamental to warfare, really, in all kinds. But, particularly within counterinsurgency doctrine, there's a lot of emphasis on trying to find ways to divide up coalitions along religious, ethnic, racial, gender and ideological lines, right? So this is also why, just as an aside, things like the human rights realm and stuff like that can be useful, because you get people, working on issue-based activism that seems progressive, right? Because you're like, hey, we want to expand rights in this particular area or in this particular area, et cetera. But it's not taking in, into sort of the totality isn't really taken into consideration. So one of the reasons that the counterinsurgency war in Malaya is still taught within counterinsurgency doctrine is because of its effectiveness in manipulating these divisions. So you write in the piece kind of discussing how this is done or how it was done. Would you mind kind of sharing some of the methods that were used?
I think to just explain a little bit about, what Malaya was at the time. So Malaya was actually a Muslim majority country. So, and also when we talk about communism in Malaya, it's, and also the history of communism in Indonesia. I'm always reminded by what my friend in Indonesia used to tell me. She said that, you cannot talk about communism in Indonesia without talking about the fact that it came out of the womb of Islam. So that's very interesting. I think that is something that a lot of people in the West, in the imperial core, are struggling to understand, this relationship between communism and Islam. And of course, because of that context, because of how intrinsically linked communism and Islam, and also the cultural ties that a lot of Malayans have with Indonesia, because those ties were not just ties that we shared during the anti-colonial struggle, but also pre-colonial ties that we shared by sharing this cultural zone or the same civilization. So the civilization that was defined by Hindu-Buddhist influences, and also later by Islamicate civilization. So that is how tight the question of Islam and the question of communism in Indonesia and Malaya, because Malaysia And Malay people in Malaya see Indonesia as part of the same cultural zones. That means we share that cultural tie that, you know, of course, you know, we cannot, when we talk about Islam, we also talk about, you know, this idea that everything that is happening around us is very much connected. So the joint struggle has always been in the consciousness of a lot of people in Indonesia and Malaysia. That's why they had this idea to forge this alliance called the Greater Malay or the Greater Indonesia political project. You know, it's basically to say that, you know, we cannot be independent without Indonesia and as Malayans, and Malayans cannot be independent without Indonesia. So it's very similar to the idea of Pan-Africanism because of that cultural tie that you share, you know, based on the civilization that define, you know, your peoples. So because of that, I think, you know, the British saw that as something that they could exploit, something that they could use to divide the communists and the nationalists who are Muslim. So they started saying things like, you know, communism does not have a place in Malaya because it is anti-God. And we are here to protect the Malay Muslim population. So that has always been the narrative that they've used, even before the Second World War, when they were ruling over Malaya indirectly. So under indirect rule, so the British said that we're just here to advise the king or the Malay sultans who are the head of the Malay people, and we're not going to even touch Islamic affairs. So we're just going to let the king or the sultans decide, you know, how Islam is supposed to be administered in the country. But it what that I mean, that is what they try to portray to show that, you know, we are not going to like meddle when it comes to Islamic affairs. But what they did to Islam at the time was actually they bureaucratized Islam by using the Malay rulers, giving them this position, you know, in the state, right? As the head of the religion. And they started forming a lot of institutions where they would pay salaries to religious figures to administer Islam, the kind of Islam that they would approve of. So that is how they severed the ties, you know, between like Muslims and also what the religion was all about at the time. Because, you know, before the bureaucratization of Islam in Malaya, Islam was actually practiced quite democratically, I would say, because, you know, you have religious leaders, so they would just, you know, talk about how they would administer their own Islamic laws or rights, for example, without any interference, even from the king. So the king, you know, they feel like, okay, all right. So the kings would say things like, okay, you can just talk about all these matters without, you know, involving me because we have all these different people, you know, who have authority, like, you know, scholars, like imams, for example, to resolve religious disputes, for example. You know, if you want to talk about inheritance, for example, you can just go to these people. So Islam has always been something that a lot of people have direct contact with. But when the British came and started bureaucratizing Islam, that was when, you know, the Malay kings had that monopoly over what Islam should look like. And of course, they were paid salaries by the British. And of course, you know, they started to understand that, you know, if we go against the British, you know, we would lose out in this whole thing because, you know, they also understand that at the time there were a lot of people talking about independence. You know, there were a lot of people like the Malay left, particularly talking about feudalism, and they felt threatened and they feel like, okay, we need to forge alliance with the British. So that is how intrinsic Islam was, you know, to Malayness or the Malay people. So when communism came to Malaya, of course, you know, they saw that as something that was imported from China. And of course, the MCP, the majority of the MCP members were Chinese. So they were using that, you know, to show that, see, this threat coming from China, this ideology called communism is going to just create chaos in this country that belongs to the Malays who are Muslim. So, and of course, that is not right because, I mean, that kind of narrative is not right because we know a lot of Malay Muslims who identified as communists. And it's very interesting to see how a lot of the communist leaders, like the Malay Muslim communist leaders, are actually really just teachers. So they were very much connected to the religion, and they see that communism and Islam are not at all in opposition to each other. So it's very interesting also because they have always been influenced, not in a bad way, but they have always had this interaction, right, with Indonesian communists. And the Indonesian communists at the time were also, some of them were residing in Malaya. So they were talking about working together, trying to build the National Liberation Movement that saw all these different alliances between, Islamists, communists, nationalists, and also how that is not just the case in Malaya, but also in Indonesia and also in a lot of other places. It's very interesting that, this is the reality at the time where, people have no problem identifying as Muslim and also as communist. So they see that as an opportunity to create divisions between the communists and also the Muslims who are also identifying as nationalists. So that is one thing that they did to really break that coalition or the alliances forged by all these different political actors. And also they would use Islamic rituals to get the communists, like the communists who are Muslims, to denounce communism publicly. So during the counterinsurgency period, they actually managed to get like many people who are like so scared of being persecuted to, go to see the Sultan to say that we are denouncing communism, and they would have to perform some kind of Islamic prayers to show that they have repented, that we have denounced this ideology and we are now true Muslims because, we are no longer associated with it. So this is something that, of course, is sponsored by the British, and because of their collaboration with the Malay rulers at the time. So we see, how this anti-God sentiment is very powerful at the time, to ensure that a lot of people distance themselves from communism.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm going to even add some related conversations in the show description as you're talking. But one that comes up to my mind, especially as a lot of people in the chat are, sort of thinking through this relationship between communism, Islam, and also anarchism and socialism, that we had a really good conversation a few years ago with Nazia Kazi, and her work is like part of her work, at least, is really about how, like the US, for instance, right, the CIA and everything, that they have deliberately funded and promoted certain variants, certain political trajectories of Islam, that are more right wing, that are, more nationalistic, but also, reactionary in a lot of ways, and not left wing, not socialist, not, democratic, not anarchistic, et cetera. And I think, and she also talked about the inverse of like in Malaya and Indonesia and in other places, how they, not just the US, obviously the British Empire as well, but how these, ruling Western powers actually really very much funded and, well, not funded, they attacked, right, the communists and the more left wing versions of Islam, very viciously. And often their promotion of the right wing was directly kind of for that purpose as well. And so, I mean, obviously people know, the kind of history of the United States with Osama bin Laden and all of that kind of stuff. But it's a much like larger political project that the West has engaged in over decades. It's not just like, one or two instances of it. So anyways, really appreciated that. The other thing too that came to mind is we had a conversation with Maryam Kashani a couple years ago, and she talked a lot, even within the US context, about how, you have, and people know, we just may rest in peace. A$AP Brown, known as Jamil Abdullah Abdul El-Amin, just passed away. But many people from like the Black Liberation Army or the Black Panthers, and other people in the sort of black left from the 60s, 70s and onward, became Muslims, right? And so I just think that, yeah, it's important for people to understand that, this image that people have of Islam as a kind of, right wing or something like that, that it certainly doesn't have to be that way at all. And yeah, and people brought up Malcolm, of course, Malcolm X, right, who's very important to Kashani's book as well. But anyways, I appreciate you sharing some of that context from Malaya. All right, my next question is, you talk about the use of the civilizing mission and this notion of the colonial forces being there as, protectors, and draw parallels here to Palestine and the demonization of armed resistance forces. You write about the Philippines in this piece as well. Oh, sorry, you don't write about the Philippines in this piece as well, but you mentioned this to me recently. And I wonder if you saw parallels there as well in terms of, the way that, I guess, thinking about armed resistance and how these groups are demonized, as well as how the imperial forces promote themselves as protectors against these armed forces. And yeah, just some of the ways that the civilizing mission explanations look in the context of counterinsurgency campaigns.
I think when we talk about counterinsurgency, it's important to bear in mind that it's not just about killing insurgents, it's also about pacifying populations or, subjugated, colonized populations. It's also about trying to win, their hearts and soul and minds, right? So by showing that you are protecting them from threats of communism, for example, so that somehow reinforces this idea that we are here to protect you. And just in the case of Malaya, for example, I mean, they use that again over and over again, to justify the fact that we are here to protect the Malays against the Chinese. We are here to protect you against the Malays against communism. And of course, they have to create that idea that they are there, in good faith, in trying to really make people feel like, oh, because communism is anti-God, because communism is just going to destroy religion. So that's why we have to really pledge allegiance to imperialism and also their collaborators, because these are the only people that would protect us from all these threats. So, and of course, this is something that I see particularly in Malaysia recently, because our Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, he's ranked as the 10th most influential Muslim leaders recently by Saudi Arabia. And last year, it was only last year, so when the genocide in Gaza was still unfolding, he signed an agreement with Lockheed Martin, and where we had to pay $80,000 to buy weapons from Lockheed Martins. And a lot of Malaysians, we're purportedly pro-Palestine as a country, but a lot of Malaysians defended that agreement that our prime minister signed with Lockheed Martin by saying that we still need to defend our country, right? So we need US weapons. We need all these weapons, produced, by all these Western companies to protect us. And it's really interesting because, no one is asking the question, like, protect us from whom? And this is the same narrative that you see in the Philippines, because they feel like, because the Philippines, they have all these military bases, right? US military bases. And a lot of people feel like, yeah, we need all these bases. We need US presence because they would protect us from China, because China would come and colonize us if the US, left this country, or if the military bases were dismantled. So, of course, this is something that we see a lot in Southeast Asia. And of course, it has a lot to do with normalization with Israel and also the US. You see in Indonesia is the largest Muslim majority country in the world. And you see Prabowo, the current president, trying to justify having good relations with Israel and also the US. And we know that Malaysia also, as this anti-communist arc, contributed or paved the way for the anti-communist massacres in 1965. And that was why Sukarno at the time, after the formation of Malaysia in 1963, he started this military operation called Konfrontasi, because he knew what the US and Britain were up to at the time. He understood that Malaya was being used as an anti-communist arc to contain communism in the region, and also stop communism from spreading in the Philippines and also in Indonesia. And we saw that violence inflicted on hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia. I have a friend, a comrade of mine from Indonesia. She told me that when that happened, she was 10 years old. So she woke up one day, she wanted to go to school. And when she got out of the house, she saw severed heads, in her village. And she is still here to tell us this story. So this is the kind of violence that is very much still recent, I would say. But it's just sad that even in Indonesia, a lot of people have forgotten about this history. They have forgotten about the socialist project that they used to have, and how Indonesia too, just like Malaysia, just like Thailand, just like Burma, the discourse about mobilization, about mass organizing, is also centered on the idea of human rights, never about, political or economic sovereignty, never about how US imperialism continues to be the primary contradiction that is causing a lot of suffering in countries like Indonesia, in the Philippines, and of course Malaysia. A lot of people would argue that, we are not, we are not suffering as much because, we are a developing country. Yes, but we continue to play that role, to, because everyone looks up to Malaysia and they feel like, oh, Malaysia is leading, particularly, in relation to Indonesia, because we are also a Muslim majority country, and they want to become like Malaysia, like Indonesians now. They're like, oh, look at Malaysia, like, look at Anwar Ibrahim. I mean, we should talk more about progress in that sense. So, what enrages me all the time is the fact that colonialism or imperialism, both, right? They, the erasure, the silencing of our own radical histories in the region make us somehow feel like, there's no need to even talk about what's going on in the world because we are not affected by that. So a lot of Malaysians feel that way because they feel like, we are okay, and we can become like Singapore if we pay more attention to progress, if we, have good relationships with capitalist countries like the US. Yeah, it's of course because of forgetting. It's of course because of that collective amnesia that we have been suffering for so long. And this is something that, we still have to grapple with, I would say. And also it's funny because I still, learning about the history, the radical history in Malaya, learning about our own radical ancestors, and some of them are still alive, and I have the opportunity to sometimes to be in their company, to listen to their stories, to learn from them, and at the same time you see, how counterinsurgency has been so successful that people don't even think for a while about the connection between what is happening in Palestine, for example, and the state of our country, because we are so we have been defanged, any revolutionary potential that we had back then, had been defanged for so long, and now we're just confused. We don't even know who we are. It's like, when Fanon talks about the racialized aspect of colonialism, it's about, how the self is gone. We don't even know like what the self is really. Because of course counterinsurgency plays a big role in erasing that history of ours that our ancestors have always been part of that history. They have always been the makers of that history. It's just that now we don't even know where to begin, to continue that struggle. So I went to the Philippines really to meet with my comrades and just talk about what do we do about our region, because our people have completely forgotten about their own radical histories. And how do we revive, that anti-colonial transnational solidarity that we used to have? Remember Bandung in 1955? And that was, I mean, that happened when the counterinsurgency war in Malaya was unfolding, but people were still trying to find ways to give clarity on how the struggle should be advanced and what we can do collectively to really resist imperialism, not just in the region, but also elsewhere, all over the colonized world. So yeah, it's just difficult, I think, for me to grapple with this question, because I'm also somehow got affected by this collective amnesia that was imposed back then, during the emergency, and it continues to be perpetuated, all these different strategies, to defang us, to demobilize us when it comes to thinking about how do we continue the struggle that our ancestors waged before us.
Yeah, I think everybody's trying to answer that question in some way or another, but I recognize it's specific, to your context and to, it always has the specific elements of it. So I'll come back to some other stuff related to this, but I wanted to kind of ask you your thoughts on kind of how you understand counterinsurgency as a form of war emerging, because you probably heard me in the intro kind of, thinking out loud about this, and there probably will be people in the chat, people who have done this before when I've talked about it, of saying, we shouldn't even use the term counterinsurgency. We should talk about counter-revolution, or we should say colonial war, right? Which, like, to me, those are synonyms in a lot of ways. And it was interesting, I think it was in your piece actually, that somebody said that actually they didn't, the folks that were engaged in the counterinsurgency in Malaya didn't even want to refer to the communists as insurgents, because they felt actually like that legitimated them in a certain way that they didn't want to, which I thought was interesting in itself, because I've heard the counter argument to that as well, of saying, calling ourselves insurgent or whatever is actually using the state's term, right, which is connected to terrorists and all these other things. So I guess my question for you more specifically is, are there specific features of counterinsurgency that you feel like, differentiated a little bit from older tactics of colonial rule? Or is there a specific utility for you to look at the war in Malaya through this lens of counterinsurgency?
I mean, that is a very good question, actually. And I don't know if I have the answer to that question right now, but I see counterinsurgency as a technology of power or a modality through which colonialism and imperialism are legitimized. I just see how, I feel like it is part of the broader war, imperialist war waged against colonized people. And I mean, I'm reminded of what Fanon wrote in The Wretched of the Earth. He noted how Fidel Castro, when he went to the UN and spoke at the UN, he was in military uniform. He said that that demonstrates Fidel's consciousness of the continuing existence of the rule of law. I feel like counterinsurgency is just another tool used by imperialists to really strengthen imperialism. And of course, the broader war that they waged against colonized people is something that is continuing, of course. And it is something that we have to confront by thinking about how to deal with this question of counterinsurgency, right? That has defanged and demobilized a lot of movements to resist capitalism, to resist imperialism, to resist racism. So I feel like counterinsurgency, just like race, is just another tool used by imperialist powers to strengthen their grip on the colonized world. And of course, when we talk about countries, I've mentioned this earlier, that it's not just about physical violence. I think it's also about epistemic violence enacted against the colonized people. So they kill people who were resisting against them, yes. But at the same time, they also tried to erase the histories of those people. They tried to erase the radicalism embodied in their movements. They tried to instill a lot of suspicions amongst the general populations about the legitimacy and the genuineness of the liberation struggles that these freedom fighters were leading at the time. So I feel like that is something that continues to be used today. They're not killing insurgents anymore as much as they did before, I would say, like even in Southeast Asia as a region, but they're just using all these narratives about anti-communism. They're just using narratives that all these movements against imperialism are communist controlled, are unpopular, are also disunited. And we see this, how they employ the same narrative against the axis of resistance in the case of Palestine, and how, it's really interesting to see how that manifests itself in real life when we see a lot of people who identify as Marxist saying things like, "Oh, I support the PFLP, but not Hamas." Because Hamas, they're Islamist, and I don't think, they're going to be democratic when they manage to get what they want. So this is the same narrative that we see, being employed and also perpetuated by a lot of people who don't realize that this is part of counterinsurgency. It has been used for so long to delegitimize all these legitimate struggles for liberation. Particularly, I think the case of Palestine is something that is so glaring that we cannot really escape. We have to look at it and look at how, a lot of people are still trying. I mean, particularly people in the Imperial Court and in the West, they're still trying to, like, how do we position our support when it comes to armed resistance? Because Hamas, they're Islamists, so they cannot be legitimate actors, political actors. And yeah, I mean, you see this. I cannot remember his full name. Gordon, Lewis Gordon, this scholar who wrote. I mean, he built his own. I mean, his entire career on the legacy of Fanon, and he was basically saying that the resistance in Palestine is basically nothing but terrorism, trying to really show how, it is not at all in line with what Fanon said in The Wretched of the Earth. It's quite ironic to me because Fanon was involved in the Algerian liberation movement. He was there. He's not just talking, writing about anti-colonial struggles. He was part of that movement. So I think for a lot of people who claim to care about the struggle for liberation, really no investigation, no right to speak. I mean, we have to understand that, right? So if you know nothing about the situation on the ground, if you're not at the forefront of the struggle, I don't think you have a right to condemn people who are confronting imperialist violence head on. So, yeah.
Absolutely. That was, yeah, no, great. Appreciated. So another thing, and you've already kind of alluded to this, is the question of alliances. And you talk about how in the UK currently there are progressives who are both citing the so-called benevolence, we talked about this a little bit earlier, of the UK, presumably in opposition to, the barbarity of Israel, right? And seeking alliances with white supremacists, and we have the same thing here in the United States. And you reference that it's both white and non-white folks in your piece. And yeah, I mean, it can be folks who are even just, part of the Palestinian solidarity movement. We posted some videos and there's clips. Like, we had conversations with Stephen Salaita and Louis Alday recently, and it wasn't the focus, but I kind of asked them both this question. Stephen, because he, lost his job, because of right-wing forces, as along with, Zionists in the United States. And so some of the very same people, like Tucker Carlson, that people are saying, oh, well, maybe we should listen to him now because he's, taking a critical line on the US relationship with Israel right now. He was, his publications and his networks were key to what promoted, the attack campaign on somebody like Stephen Salaita. So anyways, they both kind of talked in their own ways about the dangers from their views of aligning with people like Tucker Carlson or Candace Owen or Nick Fuentes. Candace Owens, sorry. And, Louis pointed out in his view that there's likely a more nefarious, kind of count. I'm putting words in his mouth a little bit, but I'm reading between the lines too of what I think that he was getting at, right? Is that kind of nefarious counterinsurgent plan behind the promotion of ostensibly pro-Palestine or anti-Zionist politics within these far-right spheres, right? Saying that he doesn't think that, I mean, he did say that the grifter element is part of it, probably, but that there's also probably something much more coordinated in terms of these right-wing, well-funded, well-connected, millions of followers, often, influencers, basically, right? Or media representatives, them taking this line, in this time. And so I know this was one of the kind of phenomenon, because we talked a little bit before we started, that you were thinking about and addressing of people, making these arguments of Palestine, folks who are pro-Palestinian in this moment, should align with the right, right? The right seems to be more interested in, cutting ties with Israel in the UK or in the US than the left. And part of the problem, which I recognize, is that liberals don't seem interested in it at all, right? And so this is part of where it gets, I think, tricky for folks, right? As in answering this question, is that when you look at, something like labor or the Democratic Party, I think you can unfortunately make an argument that it looks like they're more, willing to support Israel to, the hilt than maybe some of these right-wing actors are. Of course, we see what Trump is doing, right? So it's also like, there's when you look at the Republican administration, it's not any better, certainly. But What do you think about this kind of these relationships? Because this is part of what you're talking about in the piece too, is this question of, the right and anti-colonial movements and international solidarity, really.
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote that piece, I was actually referring to the discourse on Twitter that had been going on for almost a week about how people who, in the UK particularly, they call themselves progressives, right? And they were calling for alliances to be forged with white supremacists because they felt like Britain is under attack. Because Israel is controlling Britain. So that is where they're coming from, actually. So they feel, and even it's funny because they're like, oh, we have to free Palestine and we have to free Britain. It's like Britain is being colonized by the Jews, by the Zionists, right? It's just, for me, it's just bizarre to see this kind of discourse, particularly coming from people who claim to care about the Palestinian cause. What do you mean when you say that you want to align with white supremacists? I mean, is it, I mean, I'm trying to extend the benefit of the doubt because some of these people are being persecuted by the state. Yeah, they're some of them have lost their jobs because of their opinions on Palestine, because of the support for Palestine. But at the same time, when you are saying things like we have to save Britain from Jewish supremacy, what are you talking about? Are you, because for me, it is clear that you are trying to normalize the idea of empire. You are trying to normalize this idea of white supremacy, this ideology that has caused so much pain and suffering around the world, the ideology that justifies colonialism and imperialism, the ideology that justifies violence and war and aggression. It's just because, oh, I am in the Imperial Corps. I can't, you know, I can't help but think that this is something that you are okay with because of your positionality, because you are in the Imperial Corps. You benefit from the Imperial Corps. You benefit from the wealth that was stolen from the colonized world, right? So that's why you feel like, yeah, it's okay for me to defend my country because you are a citizen of the United Kingdom. For me, it's just bizarre that you would make that kind of argument while saying that, you know, we care about Palestine because have you not seen what the white supremacists have done? Have you not seen what white supremacy has caused, you know, when we talk about Palestine, you know, white supremacy, Jewish supremacy is just another branch of white supremacy. It comes from that ideology, that racial supremacist ideology. And it's not just I mean, it's not just unique to the question of Palestine or the question of Jewish supremacy. We in Malaya, the British gave birth to this ethno-colonial state. They used Malayness and Islam to justify Malay supremacy as a tool, you know, for the neo-colonial Malay ethno state to be used as a tool to inflict so much suffering and pain on other people around us, and not just other people around us, and also on the Malayan people who were resisting US imperialism and also British imperialism at the time, because we have to remember in the 60s, you know, the US was actually already in place in Southeast Asia, you know, because what they wanted to do with Britain at the time to turn Malaya into this anti-communist arc, they have achieved that, you know, in 1960 after the emergency came to an end. And when you say that, oh, we have to align with white supremacists, this is what you are legitimizing. You are basically ignoring the fact that colonized peoples all over the world have always upheld this idea of joint struggle. We've always tried to forge anti-colonial transnational solidarity. We have always to, we have always tried to give clarity on the nature, the barbaric nature of US imperialism, US-led imperialism right now, and what's happening in Palestine is just another example of how this bloodthirsty empire has been doing things. So I think it's because you don't feel the urgency to think about others, right? You feel like this question, the Jewish question or Jewish ethnostate, is something that is so unique that other people just don't matter anymore. And it's so funny because if you look at people at the forefront of the struggle, the PFLP, the people in the axis of resistance, people who are taking up arms, putting their lives on the line to defend Palestine, they have always stressed the need for internationalism. They have always made that connection clear that we can never be free as long as US-led imperialism is still haunting the colonized world. So I don't know, it's just I'm still struggling to understand where these people are coming from. It's just I feel like our duty right now is to really start thinking about how all these narratives, all these discourses are legitimizing US imperialism, like US-led imperialism, and that is not going to help our cause at all. That is not going to help us understand that the primary contradiction that is causing so much pain and suffering in this world is the US. So it's just, I don't know if I answered your question because I'm still struggling to understand, like what is the logic that governs this sort of thinking to feel that Israel as a political project is so unique? It's something that has never happened before, in the history of the world. It's just misleading, I would say, to also divorce the question of US imperialism from Zionism. Because if you read, the works of people who are at the forefront of the struggle, you can see how clear they are about showing the connection between Zionism and US imperialism. So US imperialism needs Zionism to continue to dominate the world, to continue to strengthen the hegemony, to continue to get legitimacy, to ensure that they can exist in perpetuity. So, yeah.
I mean, that's a great answer. I think there's two elements of it that, I'm thinking about. One is, I mean, one, I don't know if you said, like, maybe we should say a little bit more about how the one people asked about Singapore and Brunei in the chat as well. And I know that's something that your piece talks about a little bit and is an important part of this history as well, in terms of carving up, right, the region, which is a part of kind of counterinsurgency. And you referenced in that discussion this concept of Malay supremacy as well. And so, maybe that maybe we could talk a little bit about that element of the kind of counterinsurgent campaign or the, colonial management there. The other thing too, based on what you said, is just that, I mean, I really think that the big question or the big issue that I see more than anything in these forms of alliances, I mean, obviously there's the one you talk about, what you're talking about, which is true in terms of, it becomes a way to kind of, a scapegoat and to not question empire and imperialism and your state's own role, or to suggest that your state is only doing the things that it's doing because it has to be controlled by Israelis or whatever, right? Rather than, it actually understands its own interests in the world and is trying to manage based on how it understands its own interests, which then means you have to have a bigger discussion about how do you transform, you know, the way that your society constructs those things. But also, like, and I think this is connected to the counterinsurgency campaign as well, and to, you know, U.S. histories or U.K. histories of these things, right, is to understand that the right is anti-immigrant. It is anti-Muslim. It is, you know, for ultimately, you know, in the long term, an ethno state of its own, always try. I mean, in the United States right now, they're trying to undermine birthright citizenship, right, so that they can actually denaturalize people. Like, that is part of the goal, to be able to deport folks and things like this, and or to be able to, you know, remove rights from people as citizens. And I think that that, like, to think that a movement which has to be based upon, you know, connections to, you know, communities that are displaced, and you know, people who are Muslim, right? Like, all of these things, to think that your political alliance would be to sort of join or promote people who, I mean, literally on the same shows, these folks, it'll be like, you know, they're talking about whatever, like, you know, how Christians in Palestine are under attack and we should be supporting them as Christians or whatever. And then it'll be like, hey, like, you know, commercial time, right? Come watch my documentary about how the cartel in your neighborhood is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, right? Or like the next thing is like, I have a plastic weapon that you can take into cities to defend yourself against, you know, scary black and brown folks that might come up to you. Like, so it's like, it's literally in the same content a lot of times. And I feel like people who make these arguments, like, a lot of times, I don't know if they're just watching clips that people say where they seem like emotionally, you know, moved or upset or whatever, and they think like, I want to see that energy from other people on a big platform and stuff like that, or if they're actually watching the whole content. And then if they are, like, I don't know how they reconcile everything that's going on in their head. So sorry, I know I kind of went all over there in the response, but maybe, I mean, anything you want to say in response to that, but also the piece around Malaya, you know, and then Singapore and that kind of piece as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is actually a great question. So when I remember I mentioned about the formation of Malaysia in 1963, that was actually also another attempt to curb communism in what the British called at the time Borneo. So Borneo consists of three states, Sarawak, Sabah, and Brunei. So I recently, like a few months ago, actually went to visit veterans of the North Kalimantan Communist Party. It's really, really, really interesting, you know, to learn about the people's uprising in what they call North Kalimantan. So basically Sabah, Sarawak, and also Brunei. So Malaysia, so knowing that, you know, there's this movement or there's this uprising led by the NKCP at the time, the Communist Party of the of North Kalimantan, you know, in, of course, they were working with people in Brunei. Brunei is a majority Muslim country, and also Sabah and Sarawak, how the Aboriginal people, you know, they were also part of that movement. This is something that I should also note, because one of the strategies in counterinsurgency is also trying to use the Aboriginal peoples against the communists, because they would also, you know, of course there are Aboriginal peoples who serve as informants, and they would use all these accounts by all these informants to say that, oh, the communists terrorized us when they were in the jungle, you know, in the forests of Malaya. But it's very interesting if you look at the works done by a lot of people who are working closely with the Aboriginal peoples in Malaya, you would hear stories of how, you know, they were so fond of the communists, you know, how they really tried their best to support them, you know, by providing food, you know, by providing information. For example, oh, you know, we saw the police force here, so please, you know, and go and hide something. And when I went to to Sarawak recently, 2 months ago, to visit the veterans of the NKCP. The same thing, and I saw the same thing, which is, this how deeply involved the Aboriginal people in the struggle for national liberation movements in Brunei and Sarawak and also in Sabah. And of course they documented a lot of things, that they did with the Aboriginal people. The Aboriginal people not just supported them in terms of food supply, stuff like that, but they were also part of the movement. So it's really interesting that all these Chinese uncles and aunties, they would, bring us to visit the graves of Muslims, like Malay Muslims, from Brunei, from other parts of Borneo, who fought against the British and were executed. So for me, it's like, wow, that's really interesting. And also, they showed me how they developed, political education programs while they were in the forest, and they had their own dictionary, like Chinese and Iban language dictionary, to show, how intrinsic the involvement of the Aboriginal peoples in the struggle against imperialism in Borneo. So that's why, because of this uprising that was happening in Borneo at the time, the British, of course, they felt like, okay, we need to curb that also from happening in Malaya, because you also have to deal with Indonesia, and the uprising in Brunei and in Sabah and Sarawak was also supported by the PKI, or the Partai Komunis Indonesia, the Communist Party of Indonesia, because they shared the same border, right, with Kalimantan and also the Borneo states. And of course, they wanted to suppress the uprising in Borneo, and by incorporating them into Malaysia. So you suppressed, and then you included them in this country called Malaysia in 1963, so that you can, have this coordinated campaign that would decimate the whole movement in Borneo. And of course, Singapore was also included at the time in 1963, because Singapore too was able to suppress a lot of movements that wanted national liberation, that wanted to reunify with Malaya. And of course, at the time, the British didn't want that kind of reunification, because that would mess up this whole, like the Malays were the majority, right, in Malaya. If you added Singapore at the time, that would just, they would have to deal with the question that the Malays are no longer the majority. But the National Liberation Movement in Malaya wanted to include Singapore when they were fighting for liberation of Malaya, because that was how they tried to subvert the racializing project that the British wanted to put in place. So you just see, how, things just change according to the political imperatives at the time. Because of the suppression of the uprising in Borneo, they felt like, okay, now it's safe, to just incorporate Borneo into Malaysia, and also Singapore into Malaysia. But Singapore somehow got out of Malaysia like 2 years after the incorporation of that country, because of course, there's this internal conflict between Singapore and Malaya, because the ruling class in Malaya wanted to retain Malay supremacy. But Singapore, of course, they're like, oh, we are majority Chinese, and we also want to have that kind of dominance, when talking about how do we manage all these different racial categories, right? Like the Malays, the Chinese. So okay, might as well just separate, so we don't have to deal about that question, the race question. And also because Singapore has also suppressed all radical movements, so the British, they were, I mean, the U.S. imperialism and also British imperialism, they were cool with that. They were cool with Singapore not being part of Malaya anymore, because you can serve our interests, then that's fine. But Malaysia, the incorporation of Malaysia is important, because we still have to deal with the threat of communism coming from Indonesia. And we saw that, the Konfrontasi episode, explain how, yeah, Malaysia basically managed to also facilitate that process of the elimination of the PKI or the Communist Party of Indonesia. So yeah, and it's very interesting. I mean, because we talk a little bit about the Philippines, right? So when I met my comrade recently in the Philippines, I was talking about this, about the suppression of the national liberation movements in Malaya, in Singapore, in Borneo, and also in Brunei. And she said that the British and the US were focusing really at the time on Malaya, trying to really ensure that Malaya became the anti-communist arc to contain communism in the country. So they paid less attention to the Philippines. And during that time, you could see how the national, the People's Army, the New People's Army, under the leadership of the Communist Party of the Philippines, managed to recruit a lot of people, and they were really expanding their movement. And that, to me, is very interesting, something that we can always learn, because they were, of course, they were also caught in the whole thing, right? But at the same time, the imperialists were like paying attention to something else, so they used that space to really reconsolidate and strengthened the people's movement, the people's uprising. So I feel, of course, it's very bleak to talk about the region right now because of how entrenched anti-communism is, but the Philippines somehow gives me hope because they are still there. They're still trying to strengthen their movement. The People's Army is still very much, there, trying to really strengthen that national liberation movement. And there's a lot that we can learn from them, really, how they manage above ground formations and also how they manage underground formations. I think that's all I have to say about, how Southeast Asia had to deal with this question of imperialism, anti-communism.
Yeah, no, thank you. So there's like a couple more things I wanted to get to, and then if you have a little time, we might be able to do some things from the chat. You reference it briefly. More, I think you reference it in the context of Indonesia, but it's also very true for Malaya. Like, I went on to like public domain images to look for pictures to create for the graphic for this. And a lot of them I just didn't want to use because a lot of the images were severed heads, right? Like that was a lot of what you saw, right? And I bring this up not because I want to sort of rehash all of the gory details, but kind of for the same reason that you started with in terms of, British citizens talking about, this isn't us or we're, this is authoritarian that we're, suppressing Palestine action or all of that, which of course it is, right? But that this is like the idea that this is something new or that we're being turned into something unrecognizable, right? We see that frequently of these kind of analyses that suggest, even by like US military folks, I've seen this, I mean, there was the image just last week where there was that video that came out that showed IOF troops like shooting a couple of captured, young men basically that were they were captives and they just shot them right in broad daylight. And obviously like we should recoil at this. Like it is horrific, right? But at the same time, there are these discourses that try to say, well, like that would never happen if it was the US or, the UK would never do that and things like that. And so I think that like in the Malaya emergency, there are these, all these images, and you it's interesting too, just in terms of counterinsurgency, because a lot of it when you read it as doctrine, they will talk, of course, about how you have to eliminate the enemy, right? Like this kind of stuff. Like they're not opposed to kind of euphemistically being quite clear that there is direct violence involved in counterinsurgency. But most of what they talk about are kind of what we've talked about in terms of, you try to develop support among different indigenous groups. You try to, create propaganda against the communists or the nationalists as being controlled by China or these kind of things, right? So that you can create a lot of it is about like narratives and propaganda and kind of these divide and conquer, and also stuff, interestingly, about getting people involved in democratic spaces where they can talk about their rights and like what they want for their society and stuff like that, right? But the other side of it is this brutality, right? Is the degree of violence and how the violence is very much a part of how these campaigns are waged. And I mean that like obviously literally, but also on a level of when you walk out, you talk about somebody walking out and seeing severed heads in their village, like that does something to you psychologically. It is designed to do something to you psychologically, right? And obviously we see the same thing if we talk about Gaza, right? Of the kinds of things that Israel, supported by Western imperialism, does in order, like knowing that these are war crimes, right? But it's sending a message, right? So yeah, I wanted to bring it up because obviously, we're talking about a war here that was conducted in the second half of the 20th century. So this is not like ancient history or, a long time ago, and led by Western civilization, right? In a post-World War context. Also, after much of this happens after the ratification of the Geneva Convention as well. And so, I just didn't know if there's anything additional that you kind of wanted to talk about in this context.
I'm just reminded of what my comrade from the Philippines said. It was only recently, I think, maybe 2, 3 years ago, like people from the People's Army, the New People's Army, their bodies were mutilated. And she was telling me about this, and I thought it was like, oh, maybe it was in the 70s, or the 80s. And she was like, no, that was 2023. And I just felt like, oh wow, this campaign of mass terror that we saw in Indonesia in 1965 is still very much alive. Like in the Philippines, you see this. It's just that we don't talk about it enough. It's just that even the Filipinos themselves, don't see that reality because, of course, because of propaganda, because of anti-communist propaganda, people don't see these people as human beings anymore, right? They're terrorists. I mean, they deserve to be treated that way. It's so, I don't know. I mean, even though we didn't live in the 60s, in the 70s, right? I mean, we millennials were only born in the 80s. But for me, it's just, when you talk to people who lived through that period, when you talk to people who survived that violent episode, because I have that opportunity, to still have this conversation with the veterans of the Communist Party in Sarawak, in Malaya, and also other countries in Southeast Asia. It's just when they tell you stories about the struggle in the forest, right? Of course, we listen to that story and we think about their resilience, about their sacrifice, about the strength that they had to continue on, in the forest. But at the same time, I think it's also about the oppressiveness of being forced to fight under the harshest conditions. Because the Malayan forests, the forests in this part of the world in Southeast Asia are quite unforgiving. I mean, I love hiking, but when I go hiking in Malaysian forests, it's just, I always am reminded of, oh my God, I would die if I had to live in the forest and, fight in the forest. And yet just hear stories of all these people learning how to treat the wounded, for example. So I was assisting this one woman, a member of the Communist Party of Malaya. She was stateless up until last year, so she couldn't, make her own passport, so she couldn't travel because she doesn't have that citizenship, because they were considered aliens, right, when they were involved in the struggle. But after the peace agreements were signed, the government of Malaysia actually promised that, okay, we would give you citizenship. And she didn't get her citizenship until last year. And she was telling me about how, she went to England to study medicine, and then she heard about what was going on in Malaya, and she came back to join the Communist Party. And then she went to Vietnam, and she learned how to treat the wounded because the doctors in Vietnam were teaching her how to do that. It's really amazing because she told me that, she spent maybe 10, 12 years in the forest with the regiment that she was assigned to. And I asked her this question. I asked, "Why did you join the MCP?" And she said, "I just want to help poor people." And I thought that was so profound. And also the violence enacted on them is just incomprehensible. How they are treated just because they want to fight for the poor, just because they want the basic things to be accorded to human beings. And I found that very profound because, it's like, I just want to help poor people. And she put her life on the line because she believed that that's how she could achieve that objective. So, yeah, I mean, violence, of course, we severed heads, mutilated bodies, but also the violence inflicted on these people. It's just, I just cannot imagine how do you live your life, in the forest. You don't have enough food, you have to confront a lot of threats, not just from weapons, but also from like wild animals. They were telling me about, having to fight tigers, for example. I'm like, oh my God, it's just, I cannot comprehend that really. And they're still alive to tell all these stories. And it just makes me feel like, I mean, for us, I mean, what do we do, right? The duty is really on us to think about how do we advance this struggle. I mean, they have sacrificed a lot for us. And of course, the world has not changed, but it could change. It's just that we have to have the humility, I think, having watched the discourse unfolding on social media, I feel like we have to be serious about committing ourselves to the cause. We have to be serious about deep study. We have to be serious about choosing silence and start reevaluating the things that we believe in, the things that we perpetuate, the narratives that we internalize, if we really care about the movement.
No, that's absolutely appreciated. All right, so I'm going to bring in a couple things from the chat, but I do want to say before we kind of close up, and this is timely. I did not actually plan this; it just worked out this way. But yeah, so in about a little, so 50 minutes, a little less than an hour, at 12:30 p.m. Eastern time in the U.S., we'll have a conversation with a couple of people from Prisoners for Palestine, which I never know who I can say what around based on what laws there are in what countries they're in, but they are the hunger strikers who are a part of or associated with these Palestine action cases, right? That's what the struggle that these folks come out of. And so I, you referenced their hunger strikes and just their the activism as kind of a context through which you were also writing this piece. I didn't know if there's anything that you wanted to say just regard to that struggle right now.
Yeah, I think we have to support them. We have to amplify their voices, really, because I know that it's not just here in Southeast Asia that the militant aspects or the militant elements of the struggle are always sidelined or isolated or ignored. And I think it happens there too, like in the imperial core, and how a lot of people try to distance themselves from all these militants, right? Because of course, civility, this idea of non-violence, you have to do things according to the law, you have to do things according to the framework provided by the state, you have to get police permit or stuff like that. And of course, Palestine Action, all these hunger strikers, they prioritized humanity. They prioritized the urgency to dismantle the imperial capitalist machine. And that's the reason why they're now behind bars. They have to use their bodies to really push for change to happen. And I think it is our responsibility to respond to them. It is our responsibility to think about how to escalate this movement, because they have done their part and they have sacrificed their life. And yeah, I mean, what do we do, right? This is the least, actually, to talk about their plight. But really, something that we need to talk about is, how do we advance the struggle? How do we inflict real damage to US-led imperialism? They have shown the way, and of course, the fight is far from over, and it is for us to really continue that struggle, because we have to honor what they have done for us. And I don't know what's going to happen to them, really, because the law is really arbitrary, and the state has control over it, right? So they can always use national security as justification to continue detaining these people. And look at what's happening in the US too, like Mumia Abu-Jamal is still behind bars, right? Incarcerated. And yeah, and the plight of political prisoners is not something that's new also. When you read closely the history of anti-colonial struggles all over the world, you see, how political prisoners, behind prisons, they too are also struggling to advance the struggle. So, and they cannot do that alone. We have to also be a part of that struggle.
Beautifully said, yes. All right, so I have some comments on the chat, so I'm gonna just pull some of them in. So don't forget about British counterinsurgency efforts against Land and Freedom Army in Kenya, which many people would know as the Mau Mau, right? The Africans dealt with British military and armed British colonial citizens. So one thing I just wanted to say with respect to this is there are, I mean, so Frank Kitson, who I did a two-part discussion with Orasami Burton about, I think it might have been his first, but one of his earliest deployments was to Malaya, and so he was a part of the Malaya emergency counterinsurgency efforts. He went from there to Kenya and was a part of that counterinsurgency. Also, the British military, the British imperialism, yeah, the military, they used Kenyan fighters in the Malaya counterinsurgency as well. And they may have even done vice versa in Kenya. I don't know, but that, so there's really several links between those struggles. And, I mean, I think obviously we can see, how that legacy is ongoing. If you think about, for instance, Kenyan, I guess they were police or soldiers that were used in, the recent multinational campaign in Haiti, which also is much like what is being proposed, although it's not clear yet who would actually do it in Gaza, in terms of these, you get the UN Security Council to approve something that's not actually a UN mission. And so then they approve some other group of, multinational forces to do these things, and then countries have to, basically volunteer or be coerced, to play those roles. That's kind of like the new technology of this older thing, which would used to just be, that because they were under British colonial rule, you know, they could, I don't know, did they conscript people? I mean, how did, I guess they probably did, right? Or just coerce them to be involved in these, you know, wars. If you, I don't know if you have any thoughts you wanted to add on that, but I can just move to other comments too.
Oh, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, the connection is always there, right? How, and also I think I didn't mention the fact that policing, British policing in Palestine was imported from Palestine to Malaya in June 1948 when they declared the emergency. And that was 1 month after the British mandate was concluded. So, in order to see how our oppression is very much linked. And that's why our struggle against it is also something that cannot be separated. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that a really interesting point in the piece, and I meant to actually bring it up and forgot to, but just that the 1948 connection there
Yes. Yes.
between Palestine and Malaya is, yeah, important. I don't, yes, yeah, so this you can also add this like in the comments or something like that afterwards of the stream, or if you have any off the top of your head. But yeah, I mean, books and sites and links, I think specific probably to Malaya and the struggle, you know, in the history we've talked about. But you know, first of all, shout out to Vox Umma. I forgot to, you know, I give them their, they, you know, they published this piece, people should read it. And they, we've had other conversations on and continue to do, we'll continue to do more on the work that they publish. So yeah, I appreciate their work a lot.
Oh, I would recommend the memoir of Chin Peng. So Chin Peng was leader of the Malayan Communist Party. He was the British Empire's enemy number one. So he wrote a memoir focusing particularly on the emergency. I read a review of that mem sorry, I wrote a review of that memoir on Liberated Texts, so people can just find it there on that website. And I'll share more readings on the Malayan emergency in particular. And the other book that I would recommend would be The Ark of Containment, that was published 2, 3 years ago about how Malaya became, you know, the anti-communist ark to contain communism in Southeast Asia and also to isolate China. Yeah, there are a lot of, I think I would really encourage people to read memoirs and autobiographies of people involved in the movement because I feel like, you know, academia also is not that different from the NGO human rights industrial complex. Having spent like 5 years in academia, I've seen that really. So if you really want to learn about the dialectics of liberation or the struggle, you have to learn from the people who are involved in the struggle. Then only you can understand, you know, what the struggle entails and what actually happens at the time. So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, much appreciated. All right, where did I go? Somebody said, Alexander, I think one of the most successful strategies of the system was to establish peaceful protests that appeals to shared values in the form of begging a favor from higher powers as only acceptable, yeah, only acceptable probably means of struggle or whatever, right? But that is, I mean, it's literally in the counterinsurgency field manuals. Like they're just like, hey, like get people to go to town halls and to talk about what they need and, you know, figure out which of their demands that you can, you know, develop policies around and support to get them invested in the local democratic process. Like that's like exactly what they want to do. And yeah, I mean the, you know, this idea of peaceful protest, I mean there's so much work that goes into you know, the dissemination of this. And I mean I think it's so insidious because, you know, you could think about something like Palestine Action, like Everything they did was peaceful protests. Like, and here they are. They're now branded as terrorists by the UK. Why? Well, because they actually are doing peaceful protests in ways that, cost money to the war machine and gum up the works, right? And so, if you are effective enough at doing, peaceful, I mean, peaceful is a bit wrong word, but if you're effective enough at doing nonviolent tactics that are the, that people would say is what you should do, then they'll go, oh, no, you can't do it like that. Like you have to, no, we just mean get the permit, go march in the circle and go home. And that's, there you go. All right.
Yeah, you can never win, you know. So this emphasis on non-violent protest, right? Like a peaceful protest. What when we keep emphasizing that aspect of the protest, what are we legitimizing really? We are really demonizing violence as another tactic that can be used to really dismantle these oppressive systems that we live under. So yeah.
So good to see somebody from Malaysia in the chat. My grandfather was a part of the Communist Party back in the day in Malaya. So that's awesome. Wonderful to thank you for joining us. All right, there's a couple other, these are kind of, so where do the spiritual and material worlds coincide for equality and liberation? This may have been a rhetorical question, but I don't know if you had any thoughts on this, thinking about that history of, Islam and communism within Malaysia and some of those connections.
I like this question actually. It's just, I feel like, you know, the spiritual, right? I mean, a lot of people feel like, oh, we are not being materialist if we talk about the spiritual. And I feel like when Che Guevara spoke about revolutionary love, somehow I feel like that's deeply spiritual to me. I feel like, you know, the self, right? It's about subjugating the self to the collective. It's about, you know, revolutionary sacrifice or revolutionary suicide that Fred Hampton spoke about. It's just, for me, that is something that we have to talk about more when we talk about being part of this struggle for liberation. Of course, you know, we are all products of historical processes, but at the same time, we are also human beings, right? And when people talk about humanity, when people talk about how we should relate to each other, how we should feel the pain of others, you know, I think about Malcolm X also. He was actually my many years ago when I was struggling to relate to a lot of people around me, he became that militant and spiritual teacher of mine, actually. So I learned a lot actually from Malcolm X, and to see how the spiritual is very much embedded in his politics is something that is very liberating, I would say. Because I also found that when reading the works of Che Guevara. So it's just, you know, yeah. So that's why I feel like when you talk about Marxism in this part of the world, like in Southeast Asia, in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, it is something that it's almost natural for people to relate because it speaks to that self, you know, that, you know, it sounds almost like Sufism, I would say, like the self, you know, how you have to subjugate the self so that you can be helpful and you can be useful for the struggle. You know, it's no longer about the self, right? It's about using your body, using your mind and your soul for the cause. So it's no longer about the ego. It's all about you trying to find the best way possible to be of service, really. So when I see people on social media, particularly insisting on holding on to opinions that are challenged, severely challenged, for example, This whole discourse about, oh, we should align with white supremacists, it's been going on for so long. I mean, I wrote that article last month, I think. It's still going on now. You see how the PFLP, for example, is now, according to all these people, is control opposition. I'm like, wow. Have you read what happened to Hassan Kanafani, for example? Have you read what happened to all the people that were part of the party and also who are still now part of the party? Like, how can you say something like that without even pausing when people point out that you are wrong? I think that's the ego speaking, really. If you really care about the movement, if you really care about the people that you claim that you care about, you should have the humility, really, to just pause and think and maybe talk to people around you and then, have this kind of conversation that we are having now. I think that is something that is really missing, when we talk about advancing the movement. There's a lot of liberal individualist tendencies that we have to confront, really. And if we don't, we will risk doing the work for the imperialists, and that is really heartbreaking and dangerous at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think that's a perfect place for us to close up. This has been great. I'm sure it won't be the last time that we get together and talk. This has been really good. And yeah, just appreciate it. Appreciate the work. Look forward to reading other things that you write and other stuff you do. Is there anything that you want to connect people to, social media or website or anything like that, or anything you want to say in closing?
I'm on X and also Instagram. I just recreated my Instagram account, really, because I feel like, I should use the medium, even though I hate Instagram sometimes, like social media in general. But I just want people to follow your podcast and also Vox Umma. And there are a lot of new anti-imperialist media platforms out there on X, on Instagram. Please follow them because, as Fidel said, we are in this battle of ideas, and it is imperative that we clarify the direction of the struggle. It is imperative that we do all the work needed to give clarity to the masses and also, provide leadership and direction so that we can get more organized. As Malcolm said, our enemy is super organized. And we cannot be out organized. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was great. I appreciate it. And just a note again to folks here that in 30 minutes we'll be back live again to talk about Prisoners for Palestine and the ongoing hunger strikes, which have been going on for weeks at this point. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.